Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Among the beach dirty wannabes of South Beach walked a serial killer, police said, who murdered Gianni Versace in the front steps of his Mediterranean mansion.
Mr. Versace, of course, one of the world's top fashion designers, whose designs are famous in all the big fashion centers such as Paris, Rome, and London.
This was a single white male who approached Mr. Versace as he was about to enter the gates.
Andrew Cunanan is now a target himself. Who is he?
Welcome to Still Watching Versace, a podcast about the FX series American Crime Story, The Assassination of Gianni Versace. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair critic Richard Lawson.
And this week we will be discussing Season 2, Episode 4, House by the Lake, directed by Daniel Minahan and written, as ever, by Tom Rob Smith. Later in the episode, we will be joined by actor Cody Fearn, who plays David Madsen, and the show's writer and executive producer Tom Rob Smith. But before we get into our usual episode breakdown, Richard, I wanted to get your temperature on this episode as a whole, because I know, I think for both of us, this was the toughest one to watch, but it's also my favorite episode, I think. So what did you think of this episode?
Well, I'm kind of where you are, Joanne. I mean, it's my favorite, and then I think it's really well done and sets the tone for the whole series in a really beautiful way. But it's really hard to watch. I've seen it two or three times, and it's just a really wrenching, frightening, sad hour. But because its central performance in Cody Fearn as Madsen is so strong, like, he carries you through it, and you know, you really feel a sense of not catharsis at the end, but I don't know. I felt something pretty hefty in a way I hadn't about the other episodes.
We talked about this a bit last week when we were talking about Mike Farrell's performance as Lee Miglin and the way in which, you know, knowing that Lee Miglin is already dead in the first two episodes, and then we watch the third episode, we know this gentle old man is going to die, and it's sort of sad to watch him knowing that. And I think that's like quadrupled in this episode, because if you know that David Madsen is, you know, the episode starts with the murder of Jeff Trail, but if you know David Madsen's also definitely one of Andrew Cunanan's victims, then you feel that sort of reverse chronology doom hanging over this episode more than any other, because of the like captivity on the run thing. And so you're rooting for him to escape, but you know he won't. And even if you didn't know that the second time, then Richard, when rewatching it, it's just sort of there, like, this is not going to end well for this really appealing character played so well by Cody Fearn. And the other thing about this episode is, like, I know most of the actors in this show, having either, you know, seen their other great work, or if you're aware of the Ryan Murphy verse, like, you know, a Finn Wittrock who's in this as Jeff Trail, or you know some of these other performers. Yeah. Cody Fearn is someone I'd never seen before, so it's just taking you completely by surprise. Like, he is David Madsen to me, because I've literally never seen him do anything else, and so it's just extra absorbed in that performance.
Yeah, and that's true.
Makes any sense?
That's shrewd casting, and you know, we see that in movies and or things where the director doesn't want any pre-existing baggage to be brought in, you know, for the audience. And so, even though this is a huge role that, you know, could have been, I don't know, some other more famous actor, I think it was really smart on everyone's part to say, no, we need a newcomer, because we really want to immerse you in this fraught world for the 57 minutes of the episode, and they succeed really well.
Yeah, and that's the last point I want to make before I roll into sort of us breaking it down scene by scene, which is that this is a 57 minute episode. It's not the longest of the season so far. That's like the penultimate, which I think is a little over an hour, but it's the longest we've had so far. And I feel that length, and I feel that time that they took to really sort of take you on this journey with Andrew and David. So let us dive in to this episode, which starts with some, I don't know if it's real or faked sort of footage, tourism footage about Minneapolis. And it stresses the importance of water and specifically lakes in the city's identity. This episode is called House by the Lake. So that's, you know, sort of a motif that they come back to this. David Madsen is killed by a lake. It's in flashbacks. It's a whole theme.
And he was found near an abandoned house, which is something that Tom tells us in the interview that we'll air later.
Okay. Yeah. So this is, we talked about this last week, how important it is to pay attention to the title cards mm-hmm. that will show up with more frequency now. This episode takes place almost exclusively in April 1997, 1 week before the death of Lee Miglin. So 1 week before the episode we saw last week, we're in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And it opens in David Madsen's like beautiful, spacious, airy loft in Minneapolis. And so we just kick off with Cody Fearn, like in characters, you know, here we meet David Madsen. And we talked last week, Richard, about the work that episode did in introducing the nimble sort of narrative work that episode did in introducing who Lee Miglin and Marilyn Miglin were, with some like tight sort of expository dialogue. Yeah. With David, we're just sort of like plunged. You know, we find out immediately that he's an architect because he's trying to like get the chance to do a pitch. But you know, we're sort of just plunged into him from the start. What do you think of that approach?
Yeah, I thought it was a little disorienting, and a lot of this is clarified in the next episode. But that disorientation works also for this episode, which is kind of this just really intense two-hander psychological thing. So just kind of throwing you into it and jarring you. And I think that there's something about that apartment that's really stark. It's kind of all like concrete or some cement or something. It kind of feels like dungeon-like. It's a grim mood right away. And I think the confusion is part of that grimness in a weird way.
Yeah, I would have to rewatch it, but it feels, there must be windows in there. It feels like a kill room before it becomes a kill room,
exactly.
Almost, you know?
Yeah.
And what's true about the real David Madsen is I think he was doing some reconstructive work on his loft. So his loft was sort of like in a state of construction when the murders happened. But you're right. The disorientation, because they're talking about conversations they've had over this weekend that Andrew spends in Minneapolis that we won't see until next week's episode. So it is, you know, they're like, let's forget about it, or I mean everything I said, or whatever it is. We don't know what they're talking about. And it is like really disorienting. Andrew, you know, as Darren Criss is playing him, Andrew is being very creepy even before he starts murdering people. And so it's just, it's really ominous, I think.
Yeah, because we don't at first know that he's in that apartment, right? When the episode starts?
Yeah, he just like creeps into frame, basically.
Which
yeah,
is like, I don't know, exactly. Like maybe there's some kind of symbolism there about like, you know, this kind of just regular life, but like actually Andrew Cunanan was there infecting it the whole time. We just didn't know, you know. I don't know. There's something there. But yeah, it's a good introduction to this scene.
Yeah, and we meet David's dog, Prince, mm-hmm. who was a Dalmatian in real life, but is some sort of like wolfhound in this, or I don't know what kind of, sorry. Forgive me, dog lovers. I don't know what kind of dog that is. It's not a Dalmatian. I'll tell you that much right now. And the dog is sort of integral to the whole timeline of what happened with David and Andrew, because, you know, as we'll talk about, this is the episode I think has to do the most work to create a narrative, because we know so little about what actually happened with Andrew and David, since the only people who were there died. So, you know, we know some things like, you know, where Jeff's body was found, where David's body was found, but we don't know why David goes on this trip. And we know so few markers. And so the, you know, Tom Rob Smith had a really challenging task in sort of creating a believable motivation for David for this whole episode, if that makes any sense. So,
yeah, I mean, something we'll talk to Tom about in that interview is that, you know, it's tricky because you don't want to sensationalize, or you don't want to kind of infer too much about something you don't know, especially someone who's been murdered. But I think that using that unknown quality, that ambiguity, to kind of present a lot of what the show is more broadly about is smart, and I think affords David the humanity that you know, that he deserves.
So, you know, we have this business of Andrew sort of luring Jeff to the apartment. You know, he's stolen Jeff's gun. He lures Jeff to the apartment. He gets David to go down and answer the door and let Jeff in, all so that, you know, when Jeff comes in, he can just attack him with a hammer. It's a very upsettingly brutal thing. There's, you know, gushes of blood on the wall. And then Andrew, Darren Criss himself, is just covered in blood.
And there's
it's disgusting.
Some really gnarly Foley work too. Like, the sound is pretty rough.
Yeah.
So it's just there you go for it, you know.
Before Finn Wittrock leaves us in this episode, he and David have this little conversation where he says he knows about us. And this isn't the last time the show will imply that there was some kind of relationship between David Madsen and Jeff Traill. Mm-hmm. There's zero evidence that there was actually a relationship between the two of them. That was, I think, something certainly Andrew was worried about. But in actuality, that's sort of a little bit of a flight of fancy that the show is taking, that there's something happening with them. Cause we see David dating other people. So it's not just Jeff and David, but like that is a slight show invention. Before you know it, Jeff Traill is dead, but it's not the last we'll see of him. Finn Wittrock will return as we go backwards in time. And then this scene, I think, is crucial to selling the rest of the episode, because Cody Fearn is so believably and entirely in shock here as Andrew is being absolutely insane and comforting him and clutching the hammer and covered in blood, that like I can believe anything that David Madsen did because of what Cody Fearn delivers here, with the like shaking and the crying and the just stunned silence and all of that. What was your take on this reaction?
Yeah, no, I think it's really well done. I mean, it's really well calibrated. Like, you know, I think that there's a tendency to assume like, well, I wouldn't do that in that situation or whatever, you know, to kind of like, but I think that shock, that utter just, you know, almost blank reaction is probably really credible. You know, that's probably what a lot of us would do in this kind of insane situation. And I think that it's smart of the show. I mean, obviously the show needs to kind of explain why Madsen went on this trip, like you said. But, you know, I think that psychologically it feels like a really accurate portrait of that moment.
Yeah, and like we get David's fear because he asks, like, are you going to kill me? You know, but you killed Jeff. And we get David also like pretty soon after that, like asking Andrew to call the police. You know, they never called the police. So why did David never call the police, or why did Andrew never call the police if David wasn't like somehow complicit in this? And this is like believable to me because there's this whole manipulation that Andrew does of him, like, you would be implicated in the crime, which actually turns out to be kind of prescient, but you know, we can see it as a transparent manipulation, you know, like, for what it is. And it only works on David because he's so unnerved by what he's seen.
Right. I mean, in some ways, like, this person you've just seen murder somebody, you know, who could be, you know, dangerous to you, is telling you something, and you might just be like, oh, you know, he's right. Or like, you might just believe him because he had so much of the power in that situation.
Then we get this scene where Andrew pulls out some gay porn that belongs to David, a little bit of bondage gear, and a toolbox. And this is like a debated thing whether or not David Madsen is into bondage gear, but what is true is that the cops found some, like, I think nipple clamps, something like that, that Andrew actually had brought to the apartment for the weekend, like in his luggage, I believe they found it. And so I think And that did feed into their immediate thing of this is, a gay lover spat that went awry. They were into some weird kinky stuff. And obviously weird kinky sex stuff means murder or whatever in this crazy, terrible homophobic logic, from Minneapolis police. There's no evidence that Andrew sort of staged that, but the show is sort of making it seem like Andrew staged this and that, as he staged the gay porn, the Lee Miglin murder. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know. It's an interesting thing that the show is doing in like implying that Andrew is sort of leveraging the police homophobia against them by leaving this stuff out and sort of confusing the trail.
Yeah.
Do you know what
I
mean?
Oh, absolutely. It's totally manipulative. You know, it's funny with the this stuff is that I was having this conversation with a friend about over the holidays and about how it can be kind of awkward to talk to family about relationships or whatever if you're gay because, and as my friend put it, when you're gay, it's automatically R-rated, you know, like it's there's not like a PG version of it in a lot of people's minds.
Yeah.
And so like if you found like porn and maybe some little tiny sex toy thing in a straight person's house, you'd be like, okay, whatever, you know, or the police would think nothing of it maybe. But because it's a gay man versus a straight man, it automatically takes on this kind of lurid, you know, deviant sort of quality, something that Cunanan in the show's estimation of him both is savvy to and uses, like you said, as a kind of leverage point, which makes it doubly cruel in a way.
Yeah, the using it as leverage is sort of an interesting new shade to put onto his character in general. Like I think it's clear from the Lee Miglin murder that there's a lot of self-hatred and also hatred of people who are in the closet that motivated that murder. That would be how I would interpret the evidence of that scene and the way it's portrayed in that episode. Upon first watch, I didn't really think about that when it came to David and Jeff, but, the show is like, is connecting the dots there and saying, this is a primary driver for this person. All right. And so we see David sort of try to leave a little bit while, Andrew is sleeping. He says he wants to walk his dog. We see, Andrew roll Jeff up in the carpet and sort of shove him in the corner of the room. And then we get this scene in the elevator with David and Andrew and the dog. And this is one of those, this actually happened points that the show has to navigate. So like, how do you get after on the timeline after Jeff's murder, how do we then get a neighbor eyewitness saying they saw, Jeff and Andrew and the dog in the elevator together, you know,
right.
Like what logically makes sense? Like that's a thing that made the cops think that Andrew and Jeff were in on it together because that Andrew and David were in on it together because they were seen sort of like genially walking the dog together. But we see David as sort of like a desperate hostage in that scene from our perspective.
Yeah.
You know,
it's, I mean, the show inarguably says that like Madsen was not in on it. You know, it kind of makes that decision that I think is kind of the consensus thinking at this point. And, you know, I'm not an expert on any of this by any means, but like, it just doesn't seem to me, knowing everything I do know about Madsen, that would, and about Cunanan and about what he had was on his way to do, you know, in a way that like, it's such a personal thing for him. It doesn't really make any sense as a beginning as a tandem, you know, two people killing someone and, you know, going on the run. That doesn't sound right or track at all. So I believe what the show argues, you know?
Oh yeah, and I completely believe it too. There's no evidence that other than like the early assumptions the cops made that there's no evidence that David Madsen was helping Andrew in this at all. And then this is the like really cruel stroke of genius from Andrew, who says he won't hurt anyone as long as David's by his side. And so that's the pressure David feels to not leave Andrew unsupervised, because what if Andrew then hurts someone else and he could have prevented it.
Mm-hmm.
So, so there's all this stuff with like the coworker coming by, that happened in real life. She, you know, like it, David Madsen's not the kind of kid who would miss a day of work and not say anything about it. And David and Andrew drive off in Jeff's red Jeep. And then the, you know, the, our first set of bumbling policemen arrive. And Linda says she saw, like his coworker says she saw David's body. It's not David's body, but she assumes it is. And then they go in, and this is the thing, one of the things that gives Maureen Orth license to call this the failed manhunt, right? Because the police go in and they do all this stuff. And when they later discover it's not David's body, they leave because, Maureen Orth argues because the OJ Simpson case put all cops on high alert of not doing things in a way that would get evidence thrown out in court. And that just, it just, all this misunderstanding wastes time. And in the meantime, David's in trouble and no one's looking for him.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. And they're just the police are just treating it so archly, you know?
Yeah.
And it's so, the contrast between this really nice, caring friend who we will see later in the series, and this, the indifference of the police and the sort of, you know, we can't be in here now, you know, it's just, it's really disheartening and adds to the sadness of a very sad episode.
Yeah. And this one cop just keeps going on about the buzzer being broken in the, like, which, you know, might be evidence for the case, but really just sounds so cavalier and blasé. While this friend of David's is looking on in panic and despair. So, you know, they leave the cops leave the apartment to go get their search warrant. And as they go, he says, your friend David Madsen isn't the victim. He's the killer. And it's like, no. And then we get, this is what really ramps this episode up from, good to great or great to excellent, is this flashback stuff with David and his dad, which I think is, other than like sort of the flight of fancy we had, in the first episode when Andrew and Versace were at the opera, this seems to be me to be like one of the more artistic choices is to weave this dad flashback, especially the way it pays off at the end throughout this episode.
Yeah. And the dad stuff could be really corny, you know, it could be schmaltzy. And yeah. I think there's maybe an argument to be made that there is a moment or two maybe in this episode where that does happen. But because we really don't know anything about Madsen, you know, and certainly don't know what was going through his head at this time, I think that some sort of dramatic invention was required and to kind of connect us to him in a deeper level. And I think that it really pulls that off. And by the end of the episode where, you know, this kind of dad flashback thing kind of comes full circle, I think it really pays off.
Yeah, you're right. It's like, so it threads the needle of cheesy to see like a little blonde boy in like a plaid shirt that's very similar to the plaid shirt that Cody Fern is wearing as an adult. And to see him like be so super sensitive about hunting and killing and look on in horror at the dead duck the same way that the adult, you know, Dave Madsen looks on in horror is like murdered friend and all this sort of stuff. And somehow misses that for me, just works for me. And I think it's just because it's used so sparingly, that it works for me. If it had been used, if like almost every scene had cut to it, I think it would have been too much for me. Is it this scene that is like a little too schmaltzy for you, or is it the later sort of coming out scene?
It's the coming out scene that where it's, yeah, it's okay. A couple things we'll the dad says. I'm like, is that really like, I don't know, blue collar Minnesota 1990, whatever guy. I don't know if I really buy that, but yeah.
Right. Okay. So then we cut back to sort of present day 1997. Andrew is not reading the room and dancing to Pump Up the Jam in the car, as you know, as you are wont to do when you're on the run for murder. And you know, but that's just Andrew living his highly fantastical life. And they stop for food and Andrew talks about Lee Miglin and he talks about going to Mexico. We get a little nod to Andrew's like possible life as a drug runner because he says he's been back and forth across the Mexican border lots of times. The cops come back this time with a search warrant and a forensic team. And then we see the Jeff Trail autopsy. And we'll talk to Finn Wittrock about this next week, but this is just like a really brutal body double and head double that they made to slice open for this scene. The head is just caved in. It's awful. The investigators finally figure out which dead body they're looking at, which is not Andrew Cannon, not David Madsen, but Jeff Trail. So, we get this, like, it's just this really tense David and Andrew on the road stuff, like seeing this woman who, you know, David thinks recognizes him. And then I'm just curious what you think about this, you know, this thing that Tom Rob Smith had to invent, where David talks about, David wonders to himself as they're driving the car, like, was he really worried about being implicated in Jeff Trail's murder, or did he not want to go to the authorities because his sexuality would become news and maybe upset his family in their hometown? What did you think of this connection?
Yeah, no, I thought that was, I think that's a smart scene. And again, Fern is great in, you know, as he's kind of having this revelation of a sort, or at least addressing something that he hadn't really addressed before. And I think that thing about, you know, who will buy from my dad's shop, and that's a common worry for anybody who, you know, for in one way or the other lives a life that is not, you know, straight down the middle, like completely normative, I guess. And I think it's articulated smartly in the show, and I buy it. You know, I buy that psychology. Again, I think that this episode in particular, because it's so much invented for the show, really requires that, you know, you kind of re-up your you know, trust in the show with every kind of subsequent scene. And I think that it does that because it's so truthful about its psychology and emotion, you know. And then, so if it's truthful about that, we can maybe buy the facts they invent.
Yeah, and once again, the performance from Cody Fern is so good here. This is one of my favorite shots, and we haven't talked a lot about the compositions on this show, but this is one of my favorite classic setups, which is a driving scene where we're looking at the passenger, looking out the window, and thinking and talking, rather than sort of like trying to shove the camera inside the body of the car. The movement coupled with his like contemplation and all of that is, I think, just remarkably effective. And it's cut back and forth with the cops going to the Madsen family house, telling them that David Madsen, you know, is a killer, is Andrew's accomplice, and having Madsen's dad, you know, say he doesn't believe it. My only confusion around this is, like, we get this coming out scene. So we know that David is out to his family, which he was in reality. So his fear, his fear is more the people in his hometown.
Yeah, it's more the community finding out, not...
Yeah, you know, not his parents right. finding out, because they already knew, but the community and his parents being blackballed. And I think what he says is the shame and the disgrace of it all.
Yeah, and you know, I think that the narrative that we see most... on television or in film, if we're talking about a coming out, is the coming out to parents, right? Because that's the most immediate and most, you know, they wield a lot of power over you, whether that's actually, you know, real power or sort of emotional power, whatever. But there is a broader coming out that has to happen as well, if you want it to, you know, which is your neighbors knowing or your parents' friends knowing, you know, or whatever. And I think that a lot of people can get through that first step and still have a really hard time with that next one. You know, I think that the show illustrates that pretty well.
Yeah. And I mean, it works well for David's character. David, who's left his small town to go to Minneapolis, like, he's out there, like, all his coworkers and friends know he's gay in Minneapolis, but it's back home. That's a question. And also, you know, we'll get to this, David talking about this more specifically really soon, but this idea of wanting to reinvent himself, which is something that, you know, Andrew was driven and perverted by, is something that is also of interest to David. Like, that's mm-hmm. sort of what attracts this fictional version of David to Andrew in the first place, this idea of, like, who can I be? Like, can I be this rich, sophisticated person, which is who he thinks Andrew is? And how can I get there? How can I leave whatever trapped feelings he had in his small town and become this other person?
Right.
You know. And then we get the, I want to say it's the craziest thing that happens on this TV series outside of, you know, the actual murders, which is Amy Mann in a Minnesota dive bar, singing The Cars. I actually Googled when I watched this, I was like, was Amy Mann a bar singer in the 90s in Minnesota? We'll have a piece up on VF.com sort of about how this Amy Mann cameo came about. But suffice to say for the moment, like, it's distracting because it's Amy Mann, such a famous singer. So that takes you out of the reality of it. But as you said earlier, like, it doesn't, this episode works for all this, like, the surreal moments that are in it.
Yeah.
And it gets, what did you think?
I like it. Yeah. It gets gradually more surreal and more dreamlike, you know, and I think that's what makes it watchable, you know. If it was just like really like gritty, you know, and for 57 minutes, I think it would be, wouldn't have wanted to watch it a second time, certainly. And I don't know, the Amy Mann thing in particular, I guess Magnolia was coming out a few years after this, but like her voice is so just burned into my brain as the voice of that movie and of that soundtrack that I was obsessed with when I was a teenager. And so I found something comforting, but also melancholy about hearing that voice, you know, and then to have it in this context. It's a strange move, but I think, again, like so much else in this episode, it really works.
I know you half expect Darren Criss to start singing like Wise Up or something like
Frogs
that.
Frogs to fall from the sky.
Frogs start falling. She's singing Drive by the Cars, which has great lyrics like, you can't go on thinking nothing's wrong. Like, it's obviously very applicable to what Andrew's going through. And Darren Criss like breaks down, as Andrew Cannon, as he's watching, famed singer Amy Mann sing in this dive bar, in Minneapolis. And David comes back and sort of regards Andrew. Clearly overcome and is not.
Yeah. What do we think Andrew is overcome with? I mean, you know, because I think this show it does vacillate between depicting him, Cunanan, as a kind of remorseless sociopath, which he maybe was, but then there's also this other element. And so I was trying to think about, like, is he crying for Jeff? Is he crying because he knows already that he has to kill David? Is he crying because you know, he's forever chasing this fantasy that even he knows is not real. I don't know. I think that it's kind of mysterious. It reminded me a little bit of like something from The Leftovers or something.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, yeah, everything you mentioned there is a possibility. For me, I was sort of interpreted as, the reality of what he did hit him. Mm-hmm. But, the idea of the reality of what he has to do next hitting him is really powerful too. So,
yeah, and maybe this feeling of, you know, once you've committed a crime like that, or any serious crime, your life is forever changed, right? And so maybe he's sitting in this dive bar listening to this beautiful song and realizing that, like, in some ways, life will never be beautiful again, you know? And, and even though he can pretend it will be, it's not, because he's just completely upended his whole existence.
Yeah, that's a really good scene. And I think the moment, this episode as a whole, and maybe specifically this moment where I realized this show, which was already so like polished and accomplished, might be something really extraordinary. Mm-hmm. And then we get this flashback that you mentioned you might have some issues with, which is the younger David telling his dad he's gay. You know, and his dad says, you mind if I take a moment? I don't want to say the wrong thing. I won't lie and say it won't make a difference. You know what I believe. I love you more than I love my own life. And David cries and he says, don't cry. There's no need for that, which is a callback to sort of what he said to younger David, mm-hmm. When they were hunting. And this strikes you as unbelievable. I regret that I don't have the Maureen Orth book in front of me right this minute, but there actually is, it's actually similar to something that David Madsen's dad actually did say, maybe in a letter or something similar, but it's like, it is similar to, it also struck me as like unbelievably woke for a Midwestern 90s dad to say, yeah. Right? I did like that. Can I take a moment? I don't want to say something wrong. Sort of reaction.
No, but, I mean, in many ways, yeah. I mean, it's almost an ideal reaction for someone who is, you know, conservative and religious. It's as maybe open-hearted as those kind of prejudices will allow in a way.
Yeah.
I just, and maybe this is revealing more about me than about the show. I just like always have a hard time. Whether it's, you know, some schmaltzy commercial, there's a camera one I'm thinking of in particular, where like the son comes out to like gruff, you know, alpha male dad, or not even alpha male, but you know, just like uber straight dad, and they're mm-hmm. and they're gruff but cool about it, you know. I just find that to be such a wish that like maybe doesn't really exist in the real world, although I'm sure it does. So yeah, a little bit of that scene. Rub me the wrong way, but I did like when he said, are you telling me this because you just got into school or whatever? He gets into grad school, I think it is, or he won some prize. And then David's like, well, yeah, you know, good news, bad news. And I think that's a nice little, detail that's in there.
Yeah. And the way he says it, he like gestures, he's like, well, you know, good news, and sort of gestures to his prize. Yeah. And then like sort of gestures to this moment. It's funny and it's sad and it's sweet. And then we cut immediately to this like hell that David's currently in. He was asleep and dreaming of this, I guess, and wakes up and he tries to run. He has no shoes on and Andrew catches him. And, you know, in that like really creepy, like, oh, you're so silly. You don't have your shoes on. Let's go back to the car. Like, it's just so, and you're like, maybe if he had shoes on, he would have made it. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. He could have, I don't know. Andrew has his gun, whatever. And then they're in this diner scene. And this is so like the trajectory of known things that happened with Andrew Cunanan and David Madsen is, you know, they were in the apartment. They walked the dog sometime after Jeff Trail died. They were spotted in this diner and then David died. So like the diner thing is another point on the sort of timeline of what this, you know, kidnapping, I would call it, was. And here we have that, exposition that we didn't get at the top of the episode, which is sort of like how they met, why a nice boy like David Madsen would be caught up with someone like Andrew Cunanan in the first place. You know, talking about this rapturous meeting in San Francisco, which once again, we will see later in the season. I mean, I almost feel like you need like a cork board of some sort to track like everything that's going to happen, or read Maureen Orth's book or listen to this podcast. But, you know, the two of them had met in San Francisco. They talk about this night they spend in this hotel, which we will come back to a couple more times. And then David turns a bit harsh on Andrew and he says, it's all a lie. You never worked for anything. It's all an act. Is that why you killed Jeff?
Yeah.
And you had mentioned, I think it was last week, when Lee Miglin and Andrew were talking, or maybe earlier, where you said, you know, Andrew loves his lies. He loves his stories. He loves when people play along with his stories. And then as soon as someone calls him out on it, it is so dangerous and scary.
Yeah.
And this is that moment where David just calls Andrew out on his bullshit. And things get really upsetting.
Yeah, because it's really the only thing you can do to injure him, you know, because otherwise he just things bounce off of him, or he just sort of processes them in a way that it somehow feeds the lie, you know. But if you just call him on the carpet and are like, this is all bullshit, that's what gets through to him. That's his kind of biggest insecurity, I feel like. And, you know, the scene is cathartic because you want, I mean, not to like denigrate, you know, his name and dead man's name, but like you want him to fight back at some point. You're like, just do something. And this at least is a verbal sort of pushback against Andrew. It's all in vain, obviously, or maybe even contributes to what happens next. But it is at least satisfying to see him do that, in the same way that in the next week's episode, there's another similar scene where Andrew gets dressed down, although that one is a lot more bruising and arguably is maybe what tipped him over the edge. But that's for next week.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're talking about. But, and then, you know, they get in the car, they move to a second location, which is by the lake, which is where David Mattson's body was found. And, they're in, Chisago County, which is a confusing, even if you're reading Maureen Orr's books, because like David Mattson's found in Chisago, which is in Minneapolis, and then, Andrew goes to Chicago, right, which is a different place by one letter only. But, you know, Andrew has got the gun on David. This is it. And then David tries to backpedal to the lies from earlier. And he's like, we'll be happy. We'll get a house in Mexico. We'll get a house by the ocean, which is similar to sort of this house by the lake idea. We'll be happy. And this really reminds me again of that Lee Miglin thing where Andrew said it could have been true. Like, why didn't you let it be true? Just sort of what Lee says to Andrew, like, you can just play along. Mm-hmm. It can be true if we decide it's, you know, it could be true. And then this moment, which actually totally worked on me for a second, this David running for the trailer, and getting into the cabin work on you at all, even for like a half second at all?
Oh, do you mean, did I believe it was real?
I thought he made it at least into a trailer.
Yeah, no, I did too. And then obviously It quickly becomes apparent. But, and you know, it's funny, when he first made it into the little abandoned shack, he's locking the door. I was like, oh, this is like horror movie shit. This is not the right thing. And then I realized what was actually happening, which again could be very corny and a little on the nose, but I don't know. I was moved. I it worked on me.
Yeah. So this is our last visit from David Mattson's father, where he runs into a trailer and we think he's cleared it. Like, you know, Andrew's after him. We think he's cleared it into a trailer. And then we find out, that he's in the hunting cabin. That was at the beginning of the episode. His dad's there pouring coffee. That's something his dad said in that first flashback that I like so much, where he's like, I enjoy drinking coffee with you, or something like that. It was just so like plain and sweet. And so you realize, like, as soon as you realize he's in the hunting cabin, you're like, oh my God, he's already dead. Like, this episode just totally got me.
There's something spiritual about it. Like, it's almost like he's going to heaven, you know, which is like not a really a language that this show has spoken before. I guess there's a little bit with Miglin's, like, you know, little weird, creepy underground chapel thing. But yeah, I mean, and you know, it's kind of metaphysical. It reminded me of The Leftovers again. You know, but I liked it.
Yeah. Once again, I was going to say exactly The Leftovers, or like even a little Twin Peaksy. I don't know. But And so then we, you know, we realized that David didn't make it to the trailer, and we cut back and we see he got shot in the back. He's on the ground, and Andrew walks up to him and he puts his hands up, and Andrew sort of shoots him through his hands. And that's another sort of fact of the case, is that, like when they found David Mattson's body by the lake, there was an error in the forensics where they thought he had been killed much later than he actually was. And there was no way for them to believe that David Mattson had been on the run with Andrew as long as he, like, for as many days as he had, without being an accomplice. So that theory that he was an accomplice stayed a theory for a lot longer than it should have. But what is true is that there were defensive wounds on his hand. So it's clear that he was trying to, like, you know, defend himself, and Andrew shot him like through his hands. And, you know, they stopped short of like showing us the hands, and like, which would have looked like Jesus stigmata and probably like way too much. But, you know, then Andrew sort of cozies up to David right by the lake there. And it's, I'm almost losing it now. I lost it every time that I've watched this episode. I lost it here. So what was your?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's something that this episode does in total, really well, but this scene in particular, it manages to be both really scary and you know, creepy and grim, but also really touching. And it's tragic, you know. I mean, we've spent an hour with this, you know, handsome, likable young guy, and then just like that, it's all over, you know. And then Andrew, this sniveling shithead, you know, gets to go, but like has this fake moment of affection for him, you know, And it's like, you just murdered him. And it's like, well, and you just know that his psychology is, well, I mean, I had to, I had no choice. And it's like, well, yes, you did, you delusional creep, you know, like, it's just, it's a really delicately handled scene, where there is a certain beauty to Andrew, you know, lying next to his former lover, but like, obviously in the context, it's horrible too.
Right. And there's like a cricket or a grasshopper or something. I don't know. It is, it's very artistically done. And, something that I forgot to mention that David says to Andrew here before he dies is he says, it's all over. And then, of course, we know, like, bitterly that it's not all over, that Andrew still has a lot more killing to do. So, and then the episode ends and Andrew's off to the next thing. And one thing I wanted to talk to you briefly about is, before we get to your great interviews with Cody Fearn and Tom Robert Smith, is I don't mind it because I do think this episode is so effective, but of all the portrayals in this show, I think this one of David Madsen is the most radical departure of the real David Madsen, in that, like, Cody Fearn, as he's written and as Cody Fearn plays him, he's almost like this kind of Bambi figure, right? You know, he's just so sweet and delicate and hesitant, and we'll see, actually see that sort of elsewhere in the series. The real David Madsen, you know, was like a quite charismatic guy. He was a he's an architect, but he's also a salesman. Like, he was known for really being like a really good hard seller, and like, you know, he dated around a bunch of guys and all this sort of stuff. And so I think they really gentled him up. Not that the real David Madsen wasn't like a lovely guy. People loved him, but like they really, really sort of bambied him up for this portrayal. And it works on me and it works for me, but it is, like I said at the top, this is the most poetic license that the series takes with the story.
Yeah. And I think that that's okay. I mean, you know, this skirted the line of, or, you know, ran the risk of kind of beatifying David Madsen and turning him into this angel, you know, this sorrowful, you know, tragic angel figure. And it maybe it does a little bit, but like, to get us into the emotional core of what the episode is trying to be about, I think that he's a really great vehicle for that. And, you know, we get to see other sides of him later in the season. So, you know, if you're mourning Cody Fearn's performance, it's not quite done. So that's at least good.
And this is the most personal. It's all unhinged, but these are the most personal killings for Andrew. Like, after this, it's just sort of like the wheels are off and he's lost control and he's killing Lee Miglin and he's killing a poor random man for his car and then he's killing frickin' Johnny Versace. But like, this, you know, this is the men who matter to him most in the world, the people maybe that matter most to him in the world. So it's a different kind of killing for Darren Criss to have to portray. I feel like he's more in control later because it's just sort of like he's committed to this crazy path that he's on. Just a really, really amazing episode. So let's listen to Cody Fearn and Tom Rob Smith talk with Richard Lawson about this episode, House by the Lake.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Larson, the reviews director of Pitchfork, and this podcast is supported by Pitchfork Music Festival. Pitchfork Music Festival will take place July 19th through the 21st at Union Park in Chicago, Illinois. This year's lineup features Jamie XX, Alanis Morissette, Black Pumas, Carly Rae Jepsen, Brittany Howard, J. Paul, Muna, Jesse Ware, 100 Gex, and many more. The festival also features diverse vendors as well as specialty record, poster, and craft fairs, and works to support local businesses while promoting the Chicago arts and food communities as a whole. For more information on tickets and lineup, visit pitchforkmusicfestival.com.
Now on the line we have Tom Rob Smith, the mind behind the assassination of Johnny Versace, because you, Tom, wrote all of these episodes. I think there was so much for me for watching the show and just like reading more about the case that was surprising or sort of illuminating in a way. What was that moment for you? I mean, either in your research or in the actual writing of the show, like what snuck up on you or did you feel differently about it once you were done than when you'd started?
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, you know, I'm starting from a... And in a way, my experience as a writer is going to grow experience to people's... to viewers, unless they were kind of in the minutiae before, which is, oh, I thought the story is about this, and actually it's about something very different. And I think that reveal, that surprise is very shocking. I think the sense of, A, that this... I mean, he's been written off as someone who we don't need to explore. He was just crazy. He was just after fame. He just sort of, he shot Gianni Versace and, you know, there's nothing more to say. And then you look at it and think, why are these stories dismissed as having no meaning? That to me is curious. Mm-hmm. I mean, he is a very unusual killer. He was very intelligent and he was very, nonviolent. I mean, if you slice into lots of killers' lives, there are patterns of behavior that you think, okay, this person was moving towards violence. And I think it's true with Andrew. I think it's a much more complicated picture. And his family background was the revelation. As soon as I got to the dad in particular, I kind of had a sense of who Andrew was and that journey he was about to go on, which is, in effect, a replica of his dad's journey.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we'll talk about that rather striking episode later on this podcast, but the episode that we're on right now is episode 4, House by the Lake, which I think is really almost the thesis statement of the show in some ways. On this podcast, we're grappling a lot with what the show has to say about gay culture in America 20 years ago, about the closet, about the harm it does to not only the person in the closet, but those around them. And, you know, in society in general that sort of dismisses gay narratives or did at that time, certainly. You've written about this kind of thing before in Child 44 with London Spy. Where do you see the larger gay context of this show? And then maybe also more specifically this episode, which follows David Madsen as he is kind of, you know, inexorably headed towards his demise, but also reflecting back on his own experience coming out to his father, et cetera.
Yeah, no, I think episode 4 is heartbreaking. I think it's, you know, we get to, I think, one of the central ideas at the center of this story, which is that you can look out on the world and think, this world is not for me. I'm not built for this world. I can't find a place in it. And, you know, if you're going to, you know, boil down episode 5, you have a man who is trapped with a killer. And the key image for me in the entire piece is when, David Madsen, played by an amazing Australian actor called Cody Fearn, almost escapes. He gets away from him, and he's in the restroom of a bar, and he looks out the window at the world, and he sees the world passing by. And you think, oh, when you're basically being kidnapped by a killer, that freedom is obviously going to be something incredible and exciting. You're desperate to get to, and he looks out of the window and thinks, what am I escaping to? Disgrace, hatred. There is no freedom. You know, the world that is beyond this window that I should, in theory, in every other thriller, have climbed out of and run screaming for help, there is no help. The people that are going to come to arrest Andrew Cunanan will also arrest me, because they won't believe I had nothing to do with Jeffrey Traill's death. They just won't believe me. They will hate me like they hate him, because they hated me before. And to me, that is obviously heartbreaking. But it also then gets to the sort of the sadness at the end, which is, even though David Madsen realized that, he is going to still say to Andrew, I can't live in your fantasy world where we're going to live together happily ever after. I'm going to reject it and say, I'm going to face the truth no matter what. And that is ultimately the sort of fundamental difference between their two characters. One was this loving and someone who was, appreciate the truth, and someone who is deluded and a liar.
One thing that I, in particular, when I wrote about the film, the show, when I reviewed it, but also something we talk about a lot on this show, is this: the series, I think, quite compellingly and importantly, dwells in a lot of the darker aspects, let's say, of the gay experience, at least as it was 20 years ago in America for a certain group of people. And, you know, I think in recent years, there's been more of a push for positive representation, right? And sort of to tell narratives that isn't just about, like, the gay character dying or whatever. What do you see as the importance politically, if there is any, to this particular story, or you know, because what do you think rescues it from it just being dwelling in this really kind of tragic, gory tale?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I think, you know, if you go back historically and you think, oh, well, the only representation of gay men and women were negative, then you can see why there's such a powerful pushback on that. But I think the push for equality means that you have to then think, I'm going to take all kinds of representation. I mean, I think of The Revenant, which is a great movie. I loved it. But, you know, straight white men do not come out of that movie looking very good.
Yeah.
But, you know, no one comes out of that cinema saying, oh, my God, that was a terrible representation. I feel, you know, my identity's been attacked because they're so supremely confident in their identity. And I think with a growing sense of confidence, you have to say, well, I'm looking at characters that are both extremely disturbed and characters that are the opposite. And one of the interesting things about this story is that you have both a gay killer and his victims are these, you know, these gay men who are these great creators. They're the heroes of the piece. I mean, the hero of episode 5, without question, is David Madison, this person who is caught up in this awful trap with this killer and still has the courage in the face of almost certain death to say, I'm not going to live your lie. This is not for me. I think there's something very heroic about him. And part of what I was trying to, you know, part of what the episode is trying to reclaim is that sense of heroism, because he's very much seen as, he's seen as obviously a victim in terms of the crime, but there was a cloud of suspicion over David Madison for a year. The police declared him to be the killer at first, the suspect in the killing of Jeffrey Trail. And, you know, the parents really struggled to clear his name. And, you know, such a gross injustice when clearly he had nothing to do with that killing. And, you know, and the episode is really kind of struggling with that injustice.
Well, I wanted to ask you, particularly this episode, there is not a lot of factual information about what happened between when Jeff Trail was murdered and when David Madison was. And so when writing the piece, what was that process like in terms of trying to create a narrative that was both, you know, obviously compelling, this is still television, but also respectful to the victims and as truthful as possible? How do you figure out that calibration?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's more evidence than there kind of seems at a glance. I mean, mm-hmm. The official version is, I mean, you kind of get into the weeds, but the weeds are really important. And one of the things that's mentioned in the episodes is that the buzzer to this apartment doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And the reason that's important is someone had to bring Jeffrey Trail up to this apartment in order for him to get in. And you know, because Maureen, who I met and we really got on with, had very much the same approach to me, which is that we both wanted to try and explain that David wasn't involved in this killing. I mean, she felt that very strongly, and I, looking at the case, felt it, you know, overwhelmingly. Her version was that he wasn't in the apartment at the time of the killing. And I was thinking, I just can't understand that as an interpretation. I can't understand, two things. First of all, that Andrew was such a manipulator. I mean, he was trying to do something with this killing, but both in the sense that he was killing Jeffrey, who had rejected him, but also trying to pull David into a connection with him, a sort of horrific connection. And I just couldn't imagine, if David had been out of the apartment, him opening the door, finding the body, and then somehow going in. To me, that just was, I couldn't picture it. And it's true, I don't have evidence that didn't happen. It's a speculation. But when you're trying to tell a story, you think, I have to write that scene. What would David have done? He'd gone to walk the dog, and he opens the door and finds a dead body and then walks into the apartment. I just couldn't on any level see it. But I could see Andrew, but we know that he was luring Jeffrey back to the apartment because they were meant to meet at a cafe to talk about their various issues in their life. And he actually goes to the cafe, Jeffrey, to meet Andrew, and Andrew calls and says, I think, something like, I've stolen your gun, which is why he went to David's apartment. It was a trap. And if you're setting a trap, there's the next part of the trap, which is that David was going to be there and then felt culpable. And I think that, you know, Andrew's cleverness was that he plays on a very deep-seated fear, which is that we've always felt, as gay men and women, that if somehow you open the door to our private lives, everyone looking in is going to be shocked and appalled and will be disgraced and exiled. And now suddenly, by killing Jeffrey in that apartment, that lingering nightmare comes true, because David knows if he does open this door, the world is going to be shocked and appalled, and they'll think he was involved somehow because he brought Jeffrey up. Someone, you know, he went down, opened the door. What's he going to say? I wasn't involved. What's he going to say? I didn't have a sexual relationship with Andrew. You know, they were lovers in the past. It looks really, you know, it's going to be very hard for David to extricate himself from the trap that Andrew sprung around him. And we do have an eyewitness that saw the two of them. And, you know, it's hard to, these, you know, you take these things with a pinch of salt, but saw the two of them walking together, and David had been crying and Andrew was just chatting at him really quickly. And so that really got a sense of one person who is distraught and one person who's trying to cajole him into going on the run together, saying, listen, you've got no other option. If you call the police, they're going to arrest you. And I think it's, you know, it's easy when you're far away from something to think I'm going to react calmly and logically. But suddenly David has to accept that his life is over. Mm-hmm. Everything he's worked for, all his ambition, and he was hardworking, he had a great network of friends and people who loved him, all of that is going to come to a stop. And everything he's tried to do for himself in Minneapolis, which is build this great life and this home, is over. And he clings on to the illusion that it's not, for just a little while longer, until finally he says, oh, we have to confront the police.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think there is stuff there. I mean, I think you're right that, you know, there is a dilemma of you are ultimately, you're ultimately joining dots rather than, you know, dealing with a transcribed or a piece of video evidence. And I just tried to really stick to what I thought were the fundamental truths, which is that Andrew was a liar and that he was trapping David. And the second thing was that David struck me as a man who was full of love and full of ambition and someone who wasn't involved in any way.
And is that,
and that was the sort of struggle of the piece.
And that's how you came about, came up with this motif with his father, you know, and that really lovely, you know, bit at the end where you think he got away into this cabin and it turns out to be his father's, you know. When did that kind of arise for you? When did you come up with that? Did you always know sitting down to write this episode?
He was killed by an abandoned house by mm-hmm. the lake. So that was a sort of... a real geographical place, and I was thinking about that house, and I interestingly had just watched Stranger by the Lake.
Oh, yes.
And so I had all these, the movie, and I had all these ideas in my head, and I was like, in a weird way, what is the thing that David is looking for? He's looking for a house, a home with someone that he loves that is safe, and that's the sort of fundamental idea of the piece. And in a weird way, that's the fantasy that Andrew corrupts and dangles in front of his face and says, I can give that to you. No one else can. The rest of the world hates you, but, you know, I love you. And actually what David is saying, well, actually you're offering a corrupted version of something that should be pure and special, and I'm rejecting it. And so he's kind of, that's the sort of the house by the lake is this kind of romantic ideal that he's chasing, this ideal that he'll be accepted and could have the life that everyone dreams of and that he dreams of. And so that's the kind of thing that's in kind of circling the episode.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's really illustrated beautifully. And you know, I think I've seen all but the finale. And I think this episode is my favorite. I mean, it's weird to say that because it's so tragic. I think it really gets at the heart of what the show is trying to do in a really important way.
Yeah, it's a really beautiful and sad episode, and I think rather than, you know, we talk about the sadness of it, I think I also find it very inspiring. I find, you know, just as a writer, getting to, you know, there is a magic about writing and reading, and there is that feeling that just from reading scraps about David's life, I could get to know him a little bit and feel some connection with him. You know, there's some sense of him being this inspirational figure rather than just being someone that people have forgotten. And that was, it felt a privilege actually to tell that story.
Well, I think that just about wraps it up. Tom, thank you so much for talking to us and for writing, well, this beautiful episode, but also so much of the show. It's really a treat, and we enjoy talking about it and love to have you on.
That's great. It was lovely talking to you.
Well, I'm on the line now with Cody Fearn, who is so spectacular in this really sad and tragic episode of this show. We're handling not just some heavy emotional terrain, but this is a real person and who really was, you know, died in this tragic way. And I'm curious, did you speak with his family at all? How did you kind of connect to the David that we see on screen? How did you find that character?
You know, the first thing that I went to was Maureen's book, Vulgar Favors, because there's so much material in there. I mean, she had spoken to David's family and David's friends and work colleagues, and she gathered so much information about him. And I kind of came around to figuring David out in a very strange way, which I'll go into. But I didn't contact the family. I mean, I think when we started the production, there was some question about whether or not actors should contact the families. And I think out of respect, I decided, I know collectively, you know, everyone kind of decided that was probably best to avoid. Especially with David, I mean, it's such a shocking death, and it's something that would be very hard for a parent or a sister or anyone close to talk about. So out of respect for the family, I kind of steered clear and just stuck to the source material. And also, when you're dealing with a script, you know, you're dealing with Maureen's research and then Tom's dialogue and the way that he writes his scripts, and it's so respectful and it's so thoughtful. And so I just went straight to that, rather than trying to figure out who he was as a person. I went in through secondhand accounts and from what I had on the page, which was a lot. And also, I think, you know, I'll say this, when you're dealing with any character, real life or otherwise, you might have an idea of the character, but then you throw them into a situation like they throw David into in the first 5 minutes of this episode. And anything that you think constitutes a personality kind of goes out the window, because it's so crazy to see, I mean, one of your best friends, you know, brutally murdered, and then fear for your life, and then figure out that you have to, you know, mediate with this person to stay alive. And I think any normal personality traits that you might have start to melt away, and you go into survival instinct. And I think that's something that I, you know, worked with a lot with David, was what happens when everything goes out the window and you just have to survive.
Yeah, and we do meet him first in this such an extreme situation. We will later in the season get to see David in a different light and his relationship with Andrew in a very different, more friendly, loving light. Was it hard working backward like that? Like, I mean, I assume you filmed this first and then the subsequent ones later. Did you and Darren have to have any kind of conversations about what the relationship had been prior to, or was it just there on the page?
Well, I got my hand on a bunch of postcards and letters that Andrew had sent to David. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and there were, you know, 50 plus of these postcards and letters, and Andrew would write to David when he was traveling or when he was pretending that he was traveling, and he was in France and he was in Europe, or he was in Prague, or he was in... And the way that he communicated through the letters, it was very clear that they had this special relationship. And it's endearing, you know, when you see it, and not knowing everything that comes later, it's the beginning of a beautiful love story. So I had read those first going in, and knowing kind of the sensitivity of their relationship. But we were thrown right into the deep end. We were thrown right into episode 4. So I think the first or the second day was the murder of Jeff Trail. Mm-hmm. And then we worked back from there. It was, to me, it was very liberating to work backwards, because what you have is the most extreme traumatic time in a person's life. And then I got to release that over the course of the series, and work, you know, our way back to how did these two meet. And so you had something to look forward to, because otherwise you would kind of plunge into how these two people met and they fell in love, and then you walk away having shot the series on kind of a sad note. And I know this sounds very, I don't know, cosmic, and I don't mean to be, but there was something nice about giving this man, David Madsen, the opportunity to work back, you know, and to be left with a moment of beauty rather than a moment of terror. I felt there was something nice about that, working as an actor, and certainly personally, to kind of be shedding yourself of all of the horror that we see in episode 4, and to work backwards and release that and fall in love and see beautiful things and work things out. And I think that was a nice send-off, you know. The way that we remember David in the series is not the way that we see him in 4.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, that's something that really strikes me about this episode and David's character and your performance, is that he's afforded such humanity, you know, for this person that, you know, the average viewer doesn't know anything about. And this is also a story and a show that could, in the wrong hands, sort of verge into this, you know, gay cliche kind of nightmare, you know, situation where everyone's playing up. And I'm just curious, like, how conscious of you were you of trying to calibrate, you know, this sort of queer sensibility and the horror, but also the beauty? I mean, like, is that tough to do in the day? Or are you able to kind of lock in on a character and just it comes naturally after that?
You know, when you hand yourself over to somebody like Ryan Murphy, you're so trusting that the larger kind of queerness or over the topness, or, you know, whatever you want to refer to it as, is something that you don't really see it. You're in the character, and you're in the mode of what's happening in the moment, and you don't see that big picture, that, you know, the bright lights and the this and the that. You just see the person in front of you. And for me, that was goal number one, is that David can pretty much never take his eyes off Andrew. And he's always got to be calculating what Andrew is thinking and how he's feeling and mediating his moods and, you know, trying to find passages of escape, and does he want to escape, and dealing with his own shame. And so there's so much internal things going on that all of the external things kind of fade away.
Speaking of being in the moment, this is maybe kind of a silly technical question, but that reaction shot as David is watching Andrew do this to Jeff, it's so striking, and it really, you know, it shows us more than if we had just sort of seen the actual act happening. I'm curious, what's going on behind the camera at that point? I mean, are you actually looking at something happening? Is Darren there, or how does that work? I'm curious.
That's you know, a little anecdote. On that particular day, we got the filming schedule, and it was, you know, we were going to be shooting Jeff's death, and this is what we would be shooting, and these are the playouts of the scene. So on the call sheet, it didn't have, you know, David's reaction and David covered in blood and David, et cetera, et cetera. So I assumed, as did everybody else, that, well, myself, Finn Whitrock, and Darren Criss, that that would be something that we shot, you know, the next day or whenever it came out on the schedule. And Dan, who's such a great director, said on the day he was, you know, filming the death of Jeff Trail, and there's blood and there's this and there's that. And then he said, okay, let's turn the camera around, and now we're going to get you, Cody. And myself, Finn, and Darren all went, wait, what? What do you mean? He said, well, we're going to get your coverage now. And I was like, oh, my God, I'm not prepared for this. You know, I was, you know, freaking out about it, and Darren and I were kind of like, oh, man, this is tough. And Dan is such a good director, and he was like, just trust yourself, Cody. We're just going to do it, and we're just going to see what happens. And if we need more time, then we need more time, and we have time on the schedule. But, you know, what did he say to me? He said, with a moment like this, it's not something that you can plan for. It's something that you've got to dive right into, because you don't know that this is coming and you don't know how to process it and you can't make choices, you know, as an actor, because you have to be really raw and authentic. And so we set the whole thing up so that the murder of Jeff Traill is happening and there's a camera over there and watching that, and then the reaction shot of David. So we were kind of thrown right into the fire, and that's what it ended up being, which was brilliant because, you know, otherwise you're thinking as an actor, oh, there's this moment and there's this and I'm feeling this and I should try and get to this and then I've got to be in the moment, you know. Whereas Dan just threw us in and said, okay, well, here's the moment. Don't miss it.
So did you know anything about this story before you signed on? I mean, obviously you read Maureen's book, but like how familiar were you with the Andrew Crinan story or with the Versace, you know, murder? And if not, like what surprised you most as you, you know, kind of did your research or prepared for filming?
Those 6 days where David was with Andrew was the most fascinating part of this story to me because, I mean, what do you do, you know, as a human being, essentially being kidnapped after seeing something like that? How do you, you know, how do you get through 6 days? And also I think, you know, what the series deals with in a really subtle way. You know, there are certainly things that are more overt, but the subtlety to the series, you know, it deals with not only how the police, you know, bungled this because of a sense of homophobia at the time. You know, it was just a gay killing and this is like, let the gays run and do their thing. And, you know, it was very much that attitude. But also the series deals with this internalized sense of shame, gay shame at the time. And it's something that Jeff deals with, and it's something that David deals with. It's something that even Andrew deals with, you know, telling people that he's straight, telling people that he's gay, not really being in one place or the other. You know, Versace's coming out. And I think for David, what really interested me was this sense of, in the script, certainly, was how he's dealing with the shame that has been following him around all his life, his own internalized gay shame, in the face of something that's so gruesome, and, you know, finding some strength within that and realizing that this, you know, moment in time is at a point of still unaccepting of who they are. Mm-hmm. I think it was sad. It was sad, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's certainly not a series that you go into and think like you're going to walk away cheering.
No, and in fact, I expected it to be sort of splashy, and you know, because I didn't know much about it either. And so, getting these episodes where we are shown the lives of people we didn't really know anything about, I think is really valuable and gives the series a lot more, you know, heft or something.
And that's where I think Ryan has to be paid, you know, absolute kudos, is that there's a switch and a bait that happens in the series. Is everyone was ready for this to be a huge, splashy fashion, you know, drama, and he really honors the victims that came before. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's so important, because in the death of somebody like Gianni Versace, we remember the death of Versace, and I didn't know there's four people that came before this, four people who aren't famous fashion designers, four people who had a family and who loved and who were brought into the sordid world of Andrew Crinan and who went down because of it, but whose stories are equally as vital as somebody like Versace, you know. And I think for Ryan to really focus on those stories is incredibly brave, and it does great justice to those people. You know, I'm very curious to see what happens this week when people see the episodes, because it's a complete change from the world that we've been in.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the colors are different, the world is different. It very much, we've seen glamour, and it takes that and strips it away and says, okay, and now we're in the real world. So I'm curious to see how it happens, how audiences react.
Well, I think the reception is going to be good. Cody Fearn, thank you so much for talking to us. Really appreciate it. And good luck. I mean, we'll see you again on the show. So you're not gone yet.
I'm not gone for a while, no. And thank you so much for talking to me.
Thanks so much for joining us this week. Richard, is there anything that you want to announce before people go? Perhaps a book that might be worth reading?
When this airs, the book will have been out for one day. So I'll be, it'll be, this will actually be my last episode because I'm going to be a J.K. Rowling style billionaire by by Wednesday, which is exciting. Yeah, I wrote a novel called All We Can Do Is Wait that is out in stores now. You should buy it or e-read it. Or actually, there's an audiobook that I just listened to this past weekend, and I'm very happy with how that turned out. So I didn't. It's not me. Don't worry. It's someone who can.
Who read it?
An actress, a New York-based actress.
Oh, cool.
Anyway, so that's what I'm crowing about, and probably will be for the next few weeks anyway.
I'm Joanna Robinson. I do not, alas, have a book out this week. But you can read some Black Panther coverage that excited about that's going up on the website this week. And we will be talking about that movie probably on the other podcast that we do together, Little Gold Men. And until then, we will see you next time. This episode was engineered by Danielle Roth and produced by Dave Gonzalez with editorial support from Katie Rich.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, "Oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?"
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.